Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, April 10th, Joe was joined in studio by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Icarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Preceptor in Public Speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and Albany Law School Professor of Law and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
So yesterday was the sentencing in Michigan. The parents of Ethan Crumbly were sentenced to prison. And this is after a school shooting case in Michigan in which your nephew was shot in that horrific event.
In the face with a Sig Sauer semi-automatic weapon that his father purchased for him for Christmas.
So you've been watching this, and I'm curious as to, I mean, it was 10 to 15 years for both parents, right?
Right.
What does that mean to you and to your family?
Well, it's different for different members of the family. Not all of us are feeling the same way, and that's to be expected, but we're all talking about it, which is important. And, you know, listening to other victims' families and survivors' families, 4 kids died. Their families feel differently about it. I think what is a unifying factor in all of the reactions is that the law is incomplete and does not afford, you know, real justice for anybody, including the Crumbly family. I personally watched Ethan's trial, and I felt a lot of anger that there weren't systems sitting next to him. You know, what about the systems that failed him in childhood? What about the school district that failed to provide him with appropriate supports, or certainly the parents, right? Like that was pretty obvious from the very beginning of what happened here. So as this has played out over the last 2+ years, you know, we're self-educating, we're learning about community gun violence as a whole. Mass school shootings are actually a very small percentage of community gun violence that happens every day for kids all over the country. We're learning about the role of firearms in suicide, not just for kids. It's the leading cause of death. Firearms-related incidents are the leading cause of death now for children in the United States. But also for veterans and first responders, the access to a weapon makes suicide astronomically more likely. So where we've come down on this is a story about safe storage. If there's anything to take away from what's happening here, it's if you are a gun-owning parent or not a gun-owning parent, you should be talking to other parents about their firearms, whether they own them, where they're keeping them. We can have these conversations in order, as adults, in order to keep the kids safe. So to the extent that the verdicts send that message, that is helpful. And there is a measure of accountability. I had a lot more sympathy for James and Jennifer Crumbly until they started talking because on the stand, Jennifer Crumbly said she wouldn't have changed anything or done anything differently. And then yesterday she tried to clarify that, and it didn't. Her clarification was more diffusion of responsibility. Yep. So it's time for parents to step up.
She said yesterday, "I stand today not to ask for your forgiveness, as I know it may be beyond reach, but to express my sincerest apologies for the pain that has been caused." But
not the pain I caused.
No, exactly. Right. She doesn't take any responsibility for her part. I mean, it's shocking. That's a non-apology and a non-admission. I mean, so almost like she tried to sound legalese in that way.
And the lawyer for Mr. Crumbly basically said that he served 2 years in jail while awaiting trial and should receive and should be let go for time served. I mean, I understand you do that for your client, but as far as what's right.
Yeah, one of the victim's parents, I think it was Hannah's, said, I'm serving a life sentence without my child.
Yeah.
And that's that, right?
So this, just to give it a little clarification, November 30th, 2021 was the shooting. 11 people were injured in that shooting. 4 students died, were killed. Several others seriously injured. The 15-year-old student was later arrested in connection with the shooting, Ethan Crumbly, as Sarah mentioned. The idea of what is a just punishment in something like this is hard to get your wrap your brain around, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I had a difficult moment. My sister and I were on national news media outlets all day yesterday, and that we could have probably a separate conversation about in terms of how these things are covered.
I definitely want to have that conversation.
I really appreciate being here. I feel a lot more comfortable here. But on one of the news segments, they mentioned that after the sentencing, the attorneys for James and Jennifer had made requests of some sort to see if the family could be housed together. And the rules of the prison system don't allow for that. And I just had a moment of, mental incongruence there because, right, that's family separation too. How do we expect the Crumblies to do differently, to learn differently, to heal differently, to move differently together? How do we expect a kid who was tried as an adult, who is serving life without parole? How do we expect that? That doesn't make me feel better.
No.
That doesn't do anything for Elijah, my nephew. And he would say that too. We've run everything that we say publicly by Elijah because he is a teenager and he is entitled to his own privacy and his own opinions on the matter. So I'm not speaking for him, but I do know that he has similar complicated feelings about Ethan, the shooter.
Did he know him?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, had class with him.
Yeah, but not.
Right before it happened. But right. Yeah, they weren't friends.
How old is he now?
Elijah, 16. I'm like thinking. 78 million years old, actually.
I'm sure he's aged quite a bit over the last 2 years. Yeah. So what, in the nature of his injuries as of now?
My sister reminded me yesterday he's getting new teeth. So the bullet grazed 2 of his fingers because he put his hand up and then went in his mouth, through his teeth, and then out his cheek. So he was extremely lucky. He lives with a lot of survivor's guilt. It could have been very, very different for him.
It is interesting. I mean, I would think it's impossible to remove yourself from that. But this was sort of a reckoning of what parental responsibility looks like. We haven't really grappled with this too much yet, as to what the responsibilities are for the parents.
Yeah. Well, and in a very narrow set of circumstances, right? So the prosecutor was very clear that this isn't, you know, like, oh, this isn't setting a precedent that is going to, we hope, scoop up people outside of this specific circumstance of buying your child a gun illegally. By the way, it was a straw sale. Ethan Crumbly is not an eligible firearm purchaser child.
Yeah.
So even, you know, so and it, from a licensed firearms dealer, there's a lawsuit pending against the firearms dealer as well. My family is also a part of that. They have not been held accountable at all. They're still operating. We drive by their gun shop Acme guns and ammo every time I visit. Yeah, mm-hmm. I always think of the Roadrunner.
Well, yeah.
That's what my trauma brain does.
It's exactly. That's like, exactly what it would be. Like,
meep, meep. So there are multiple pieces of the accountability puzzle that are still coming together. Mm-hmm. But certainly when a parent purchases a firearm illegally for a child who is ineligible, then the mother takes the child to a shooting range. Then the kid starts drawing disturbing images of shooting other people, says he's hearing voices, tells his parents, the school district brings the parents in. Like, at what point do we say, okay, that's enough? Okay, that's enough. Now, there should be threat assessment teams. There should be a lot of other things happening. But for parental responsibility, what, like the judge was saying, it was a runaway train. There were so many signs. And the parents completely rejected Ethan's cries for help.
It also, we've talked about this a lot. We've been talking about it a lot as these shootings continue to take over our thoughts, and they happen way too frequently. But I'm curious as to the culture of it, where at any point you think it's a good thing to give a minor a powerful, powerful weapon of war. I mean, regardless of the mental anguish the child was going through, that they may or may not have been aware of where that comes in, where you say this is a good idea.
Well, and to go back to secure storage, they claimed that they stored the gun securely, but the gun storage unit that they used was set to its manufacturer default setting, which was 0000. So that wasn't going to deter the child from having access. I'm all about parents and responsible gun owners teaching their kids how to responsibly handle firearms. I myself, before this happened, took a firearms safety class sponsored by the NRA, because they're the only ones that sponsor them. I'm working on changing that too, because you shouldn't have to pay the NRA to learn about guns if that's something that you're curious about. And I figured if I'm going to be responsible in talking about this issue, I should at least know what I'm talking about. And at the time, the SAFE Act didn't allow you to handle a firearm before you had a permit, which was ridiculous, because that meant I went to this class at some rod and gun club, I think in Clifton Park. I took a couple of classes. I got the certificate. I took the test. I never touched a gun, and I could have applied for a permit, purchased one, and used it. So they've changed that. There's now like a field test component, which makes a whole lot more sense. And I really don't have a problem with even little kids learning about how to use guns safely. What I do have a problem with is unrestricted access to firearms and irresponsible gun ownership. And this idea that if we just put them on a top shelf, the kids aren't going to find them. Because that's, if anyone who's ever tried to hide anything from a kid knows that that's just not how this works.
Sarah Rogerson is here, regular panelist on this program, a law professor at Albany Law School, and as well as the aunt of a child who was gravely injured in the shooting in Michigan. Jennifer and James Crumbly, who were convicted of involuntary manslaughter for failing to prevent their teenage son from killing four fellow students in the deadliest school shooting in Michigan's history, were each sentenced on Tuesday to 10 to 15 years in prison. Their separate jury trials ended in guilty verdicts in February and March, making them the first parents in the country to be convicted over the deaths caused by their child in a mass shooting. A moment ago, Sarah, you said as far as the NRA having these gun safety courses, and you said that's one of the other things I'm trying to change. What is your agenda look like? And I use that word positively of what you know you would like to see come out of this horrific crime.
Well, and one thing I've neglected to say is that communities of color experience community gun violence at disproportionately high rates, right? So we're a white family. This is a white rural suburb, very, very far suburb of Detroit or Flint, depending on how you look at it. And, you know, when the white kids' schools get shot by typically other white kids, it becomes pretty sensational. And this is an everyday issue. So another complicating factor is that although I'm happy that these parents were held accountable, we know that the criminal justice system also disproportionately targets historically minoritized communities. And what I don't want to see happen is a lot of black and brown families disproportionately held to held to account on very different facts and very different circumstances. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's been niggling in the back of my mind as these trials of the parents have gone forward. And so I don't think I have an agenda in as much as I want to self-educate, redirect to responsible resources. We have the Regional Gun Violence Consortium right here in our backyard at the Rockefeller Institute. It's people from as far south as Virginia and all the way up to Maine, I think. Scholars, interdisciplinary scholars, regularly pumping out reports that are evidence-based and scientific about what works and what doesn't work. So things like school lockdown drills, if done in a trauma-informed way, actually do help mitigate the harm caused, right? I don't like that fact. I don't like that my kids are having to engage in lockdown drills, but if it keeps them alive until we fix the other problems, fine. Threat assessment teams are a critical component of this, and they're understudied. Gun violence research generally is underfunded. So how are we going to solve a problem when we don't invest in the people who are trying to figure out how to stop it?
We've talked about that a lot, right? That we don't put that money available, and we don't know enough. We don't study it. We don't look at it. Which seems unbelievable to me.
I was prohibited when I was running the science and technology director for DHS. I was prohibited by Congress from actually doing any research into safe, you know, smart gun technologies, safe gun technologies. So it's actually prohibited by Congress, which again I think gets back to Sarah's point about the power of the power of the NRA has had. In sort of pulling the strings on basic issues of safety.
Yep.
And an organization that's like falling apart.
Falling apart.
Scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think gun safety should be accessible to everyone.
Right.
If you are a leftist, you should know how to and you want to learn more about firearm safety. You should have a way to do that.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 10th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, April 11th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
You will recall that a decision by Arizona's highest court earlier this week upheld an 1864 ban. This is before Arizona was a state. On nearly all abortions, and on nearly all abortions, stop. It created chaos and confusion across the state on Wednesday, as abortion providers were flooded with phone calls from frantic patients. Republican lawmakers of the state capitol, I hate this phrase, you know this, I say this all the time, doubled down and blocked efforts to undo the ban, prompting angry jeers from the Democrats. Democrats who, which I would just like to know, I mean, we'll get into this, but this is very different than the IVF decision in Alabama, where the legislature said, okay, obviously this isn't good. It's not good for us. It's not good for the party. It's not good for the state. And we will allow legislation to go through to repeal it. That was not the case at all in Arizona. And obviously IVF and abortion are two different subjects, but there are some similarities as far as the politics. Democrats seized on the decision to resurrect the 160-year-old ban as a pivotal election issue, try to push bills through the Republican-controlled legislature to repeal the ban, a move they said would protect women's health and freedom, and also force Republicans to take a formal vote on the law. But you don't want that. So Republican leaders in the Senate removed one bill from the day's agenda on Wednesday. Legislative aides said that in the House, a Republican lawmaker who had called for striking down the law made a motion to vote on a Democratic repeal bill that has sat stalled for months. But Republican leaders quickly scuttled that effort by calling for a recess and later adjourned until next Wednesday, when I'm sure all of the problems will have gone away. Democrats on the Senate floor yelled shame and save women's lives as the Republican colleagues filed out of the chamber. Judy Patrick.
Wow, wasn't that a stupid decision by the Republicans not to to do something to repeal this legislation? It seems politically stupid. It seems bad for women. It actually politically a good move for Democrats. I mean, they are the good guys in this battle. It's incredible in this day and age that this is happening. And I almost felt sorry for Donald Trump because the day
you're gonna get letters.
Oh, I know. Well, I did, but I don't. Because he the day after he said, let this be a state's decision. Well, the state has decided, and they've decided that abortion should be banned. His reaction, though, however, was saying something along the lines, well, you know, the state's going to fix this. Well, the Republicans in Arizona proved that they're not going to fix it for him, at least not right away. Can I make the point that pregnancy is an issue for women throughout their lives? If you have two or three or more children, your body is affected for the rest of your life. There are issues that people don't like to talk about, you know, bladder leakage and things that women deal with, you know, until they're throughout their lives. So, and women with cancer have problems if they get pregnant. This is not just an issue about having a baby or not having a baby. This is a women's health care issue that is totally being ignored in Arizona. And the political consequences are going to be dramatic. Will the Republicans in Arizona turn around? I think eventually they must, but we'll see.
Right. And they gave themselves until Wednesday. I just don't, you know, how much time do you need? Heather Mulligan is with us, as I mentioned, vice president for editorial development at the New York Press. No, that's wrong.
No,
I'm
wow,
wrong
I got
line.
A new job.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm trying to, I read out of the wrong focal range of my trifocals. CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I blame it on the rain.
Yeah, well, it was bad coming in.
And the eclipse. It messed up my circadian rhythms. And, you know, I know Ira's a huge eclipse fan, so I figured I'd bring it up again.
I'm going to blame everything on the eclipse now.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much. Good
Thank
to have you.
You.
Any thoughts on the subject?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the outrage at the failure of the Republicans to take up a bill immediately is a little bit misplaced. I mean, they do need time to address this. I think that it's a politically very problematic for them, and I do expect that it's likely, I mean, unless the really far right wing of the party is able to stop it, I do think you're going to see some legislative action there. I think it's very likely. I mean, they could punt and say, we're just going to put it on the ballot and you know, let the voters decide. But I think that would be a mistake, especially when you saw Carrie Lake backing away a little bit from her sort of pro-life, unequivocal pro-life stance and even former President Trump. So, you know, there is an awareness on the part of the party that this issue is very problematic for them, and rightly so. You know, and I'll go back to that the Supreme Court decision made the Republican Party like the dog that caught the car. You know, now what? What do we do? This is not helping. So,
Ira.
Well, unlike Judy, I don't feel any sympathy for Donald Trump on this.
He said I almost.
Wow, did I miss something?
She's not sending him notes or anything.
Here's a guy who thought he could split the baby, no pun intended, by taking credit for the demise of Roe v. Wade, and very, very directly doing that in a clip that we're going to see for the next 6-8 months. At the same time, saying this is a state's decision. And then at the same time that it's a state's decision, when Arizona does what it thinks it should be doing, he and the outcry is significant, and in Trump's case, negatively significant, he's not trying to dance back and say, well, we'll take care of that. Well, wait a minute. It's supposed to be a state's decision. So he's all over the map. They're all over the map. And, you know, I don't have a very accurate crystal ball, but I would like to think that for all of the discussion about how this election is going to turn out and how the economy is going to be the issue or how immigration is going to be the issue or how the war in Gaza is going to be the issue, the end of the day that this abortion issue is going to be it, because women and predominantly women, but many men as well, are going to come out and say, wait a minute, don't mess with this abortion business. This is what the people want. And if you don't want an abortion, you know, fine, don't get one, but don't prevent me from getting one.
I agree with you, Heather, in the sense that, you know, we'll see what the legislature does. But it still seems like they played it very poorly. They could have given a good, for want of a better term, BS answer to give by themselves some time. But it does seem, you know, just by doing what they did, that they were supporting the court decision.
Yeah, I don't think they do support the court decision necessarily. I think they were surprised by it. Often when people are surprised, they don't necessarily make the best political decisions. but I do think, I mean, I'll say this, I've said it before, that had Roe v. Wade not been decided as it was, I think that this would be a settled issue. I think every state would have legal access to abortion up to some degree. I mean, the fact that even in Ireland, you know, this is something that people want. They want access to abortion care. And I do think that what happened with Roe v. Wade is the issue got taken off the table at the state level for so long that people were comfortable staking out positions that weren't reflective necessarily of what most people's views are. And I think that's true on both sides. I mean, I think there were folks who were, you know, far more, there needs to be access at every stage at any cost. And I think if you did some polling, you'd find out that most people aren't there. They're kind of more in the middle. But all that being said, I think we'll get there. I think it's one of those issues where people feel safe that they're not going to be forced to make a vote on something. They take a position that might not necessarily be their real position if it was something they had to decide on. And again, you know, that's what happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
We're talking about the Arizona abortion ban and the Republicans looking to thwart the thwarting the attempts by Democrats to repeal the 1864 abortion ban. I think isn't that the topic, that part of the story that I think is resonating with so many people, is that we're talking about legislation that was drafted in 1864.
Before Arizona was a state.
Correct.
When the territory had 8,000 or 9,000 people, women couldn't vote. Although that's when they, you know, the Constitution was enacted back in the 18th century. So
I think it's a little bit of a red herring, right? I mean, a law, as long as it's on the books, it's still a law.
Old laws are.
I mean,
still
it doesn't
laws.
Mean it's a good law. There's a lot of stupid laws on the books that haven't been repealed, but. There's not many people sitting around looking, reading old laws to go, is this still relevant? Should we get rid of it?
But it wasn't being enforced.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And the Republicans in Arizona have had plenty of time to look at this law because it's been under debate since the Dobbs decision. I mean, it's not like this was sprung upon them at the last minute. They knew this was a potential for covering coming. And so that's why I've feel they should have taken some action yesterday or shown some, given some signal that they were going to seriously consider repealing it.
Well, what also wasn't a good look, I mean, in terms of the atmosphere in Arizona, is that the legislative body, the speaker or whatever, or the president of the council there, called for a vote, and it was a voice vote, and the Republicans were all one way, and then all opposed, and there was this outcry of voices, and he said, "Okay, we're going." And I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but it just looked like the goose. He just rushed the whole thing away instead of listening to the other side.
Well, that's what I was saying to Heather earlier. I mean, it seems like they could have come up with some response that would have at least indicated that they're gonna. Well, figure out what to do other than kicking it down just to win.
Well, in the House, when they take a voice vote, if there sounds like there's some opposition, they then do an individual vote. I mean, that's what democracy is all about. But
that's what they didn't want that.
They didn't want that.
Right. And as far as how this plays in national politics, I mean, the most interesting part of it is what Judy was referencing earlier of how it affects Trump's message and the Republican message, because this has gummed up the works. It hasn't helped I said this earlier in the week, but the New York Times headline about the statement that Trump made clarifying his position on abortion says, after months of mixed signals and misdirection, you know, and the second part of that should have been he issued a statement with more misdirection and mixed signals.
Well, so. It's 9:37. He'll change his mind in about another half hour. Whatever he said yesterday has no meaning to what he might say today or tomorrow.
I mean, I think with him, the real question is, what do we think he would do if Congress presented him with legislation banning abortion nationally? Would he stand by his view that it's a states' rights issue, or would he sign the bill? I think he'd sign the bill.
Right. He would say that Congress is the people.
Right.
They are
they
elected Congress, so he's going to let the people decide, and Congress has decided to do this, so he would sign it. I think throughout his anything he said on abortion, he will say, well, we'll let the people decide. And that gives him cover for anything. It gives him cover if a legislature passes it. It gives him, maybe he could use a poll. I mean, it's a all around good way to get what he wants.
Did you watch the full statement? Did anybody see the full statement? No. I mean, it was when he starts going off about the post birth executions.
Well,
I mean, my Lord, it's wacky town, and you know, into years of their life, what? I don't know. It's a very strange thing to watch.
So doesn't that get to? I mean, there's this whole debate going on right now about whether or not there should be more coverage of him, because you know there was a huge push to say he's getting too much airtime. Now he's off Twitter. Now he's really not, you know, on any of the networks that as frequently. And I think what happens then if he's off the air is you forget how kind of outlandish some of the things he says are. You know, this is the guy who tried to buy Greenland, right? As it's like,
right.
And I think that, you know, the kind of the craziness and those kinds of statements, they're not right in people's, you know, immediate memory. And that is going to have an impact on you know, positive or negative views.
I direct this to Judy Patrick because she was one of the panel members that we've had who, rightfully so, I think has said that the Democrats and particularly the Biden campaign have been very bad in messaging and sort of seizing on these moments. It seems, however, in the last several weeks that they're taking these comments, they're putting out videos, they're putting out reels, they're putting commercials out, and they're taking these statements and then they have Biden responding. I don't know how, you know, if they're working or not. But it does seem to certainly be a much more aggressive approach than we had seen prior.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. One of the this has been a real struggle for the news media. In some respects, they're just taking the most salient points or what they consider the most newsworthy points and focusing on that as they write the story and not the whole crazy speech. I mean, it was just a week or so ago, I think, that Trump was suggesting that Joe Biden was on cocaine when he gave the State of the Union address.
Hugh Hewitt, and that he would he was talking to Hugh Hewitt, and said that, yes, he was on something and that he would not do a debate. And we have an item on our docket today about debates, so we may get into this. But regarding that, he would not debate Biden until he took a drug test because he didn't want to take to debate him if he was on coke.
You know, Joe Biden should have demanded a COVID test before he debated Donald Trump back then, when Donald Trump had COVID and debated him anyway.
And I will admit that I had forgotten. You know, there's so much stuff that comes out of these stories that it's kind of hard to remember everything. But there was they found the baggie of coke in the security area,
right,
of entering the White House. And I guess that's where it comes from, that obviously it could not have been belonging to any of the staff or the visitors, that it was obviously that of the president.
And he uses the same technique that he used with suggesting, Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S. He's, I'm just asking the question. I mean, you're not just asking the question. But in reference to your original question, sure, I think that the Democrats have finally woken up and realized they've got to fight back and be aggressive, and they have some smart people doing some smart things. It's targeted, I think, a lot on social media, but it's smart to fight back. You can't just sit back and take.
Yes.
So I think Saturday Night Live suggested that President Biden was on Celsius when he gave his address, which I, by the way, am a huge fan of Celsius. Anyone who likes an energy drink, it's got a list of vitamins on the back, so it makes you feel like it's really good for you, you know. But it's like 200 milligrams of caffeine.
And we know that former President Trump likes his Coca-Cola, or Diet Coke.
Yeah,
that has really worked well for him.
Well, I think I can go back to one of the original point I think that Heather was making is, in terms of the media coverage. I think that generally speaking, the coverage has been much more measured than his past two runs for president. I'm sticking with the cable now. I'm not talking about print, but other than the far right channels, Fox and farther right than Fox, they're not going as live to his events as often as they used to. The other channels are fact checking in real time. So I believe in general the media is doing a better job covering him. And the fact is, as much as many of us don't like it, the man is the nominee for the Republican Party. So there is an obligation on our part to cover him, and we got to let the voters know what it is this man represents, as hard as it is to figure out what he represents sometimes. But, you know, when he ran against Hillary, he had free rein. Networks put him on because he was entertaining as much as anything else. And now that his danger has been exposed and his inaccuracies have been highlighted, we're seeing, again, I go back to the phrase, a more measured approach in how he's being covered.
Ira Fussfeld on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 11th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, April 12th, Joe Donahue was joined by Bennington College faculty member, former EPA regional administrator and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Ulster County comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and Tetherless World professor of computer, web, and cognitive sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler.
For the first time, the federal government is requiring municipal water systems to remove 6 synthetic chemicals linked to cancer and other health problems that are present in the tap water of hundreds of millions of Americans. The extraordinary move from the Environmental Protection Agency mandates that water providers reduce a substance collectively known as PFAS, P-F-A-S, to near zero levels. The compounds found in everything from dental floss to firefighting foams to children's toys are called forever chemicals because they never fully degrade and can accumulate in the body as well as the environment. The chemicals are so ubiquitous they can be found in the blood of almost every person in the United States. A 2023 government study of private wells and public water system detected PFAS chemicals in nearly half the tap water in the country. Exposure to PFAS has been associated with metabolic disorders, decreased fertility in women, developmental delays in children, and increased risk of some prostate, kidney, and testicular cancers. That according to the EPA. So now the federal government is requiring municipal water systems to remove those chemicals from the tap water of millions of Americans. Judith, let me just start with my first reaction to this story, which was, why was that ever allowed for those chemicals to be in our tap water?
Well, no one ever approved it being in our drinking water. But what has happened is across the country, you have various forever chemicals that have leached into groundwater and surface water. And unless the public water suppliers are testing for it and have a very strict standard, they just, you know, they don't take action to get it out of the drinking water. So this is, you know, decades and decades of a toxic legacy. And I really applaud the EPA decision to establish these drinking water standards. And we have a very significant local hook to this, which is the Hoosick Falls.
Right.
Yep. And Petersburg situation, and then even the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator, which I pray will be closed permanently. Norlite was burning. It was called AFFF, which is toxic firefighter foam, because firefighter foam contains a lot of PFAS. And Department of Defense sent that to Norlite to be burned. The state never told the community. We had to pass state and local laws to prohibit that. And so, you know, there's a long, long toxic legacy here that goes from drinking water contamination to air pollution if they're foolishly going to burn PFAS chemicals, which happened at Norlite.
What is it about, talk a little bit of how they get into the water supply in the first place, and how, of what goes into the process of getting them out?
Yeah, well, the good news is you can get it out with carbon filtration, or like you basically put a gigantic carbon filter either on the public water supply, or if you have a private well, you can at fairly reasonable cost install carbon filtration. You can put it just at your sink for drinking water, or you could do a whole house system, or you can use another technology called reverse osmosis. You can get it out if you know that it's there. You know, I can tell you the way it got into the Hoosick Falls water supply was there's a company called St. Gobain, which is very, very close. 500 yards away is the St. Gobain plant from the groundwater wells that provided drinking water for the village of Hoosick Falls. And so somehow St. Gobain let this chemical from their facility get into the soil and the groundwater. And, you know, terrible that the public water supply wells were just 500 yards from the plant. And so those wells became contaminated. And unfortunately, the state of New York and the mayor of Hoosick Falls at the time, not the current mayor, they stood behind this regulatory shield and said, well, there are no clear, safe drinking water standards here for PFAS chemicals. So we don't need to tell the public that they've been drinking contaminated water. And they were technically correct. The way the Safe Drinking Water Act works is EPA or the states establish a drinking water standard called a maximum contaminant level. But what happens is whenever EPA does that, they get battered by not only the companies that don't want to pay to get the chemicals out of the drinking water, but the companies, the polluters, very shrewdly put the local governments and the public water supply providers in front as you know, the message, oh, it's going to cost water ratepayers more money to get this out of the water. And so this is like a terrible regulatory failure because of pressure from polluters and the people that give them green cover, often water supply companies and local governments. And so what we were able to do in Hoosick Falls, though, is when EPA doesn't establish a drinking water standard, the EPA does have something called a health advisory warning, which has very solid science behind it. Andrew Cuomo and his administration kept criticizing EPA for first we blew the whistle on Hoosick Falls and told residents to stop drinking the water because it was contaminated, something the state health department refused to do. And Andrew Cuomo kept harping on the fact that there's no official drinking water standard and the health advisory warning doesn't have the same legal effect as an official drinking water standard. So this announcement by EPA this week takes that defense away from the Andrew Cuomos of the world. I'm sorry if this is rambling. I want to make two other points. One is it's a very good regulation that's going to save lives and avoid cancer incidents. But we're not out of the woods because the polluters will sue to try to get this overturned. And my second point is what you hear from polluters and sadly from government regulators sometimes is forever chemicals are everywhere. PFAS is everywhere. You know, we really, we can't chase down every last molecule. So now what's often happening is when contaminated drinking water is discovered, eventually carbon filtration is installed. But then the regulatory agencies do not aggressively go look for the source of the PFAS. So while our top priority is always protecting public health and making sure that people are not drinking contaminated water, it's also important that you find out where the PFAS is coming from, and that you require companies like Saint-Gobain and Honeywell and others to clean up their messes, not that they just walk away because carbon filters are installed on drinking water supplies.
I'm so happy to hear Judith say that as a elected official on the finance side. You know, my county doesn't operate any water systems, but plenty of our towns and villages do. And I think it's interesting that we've seen these large settlements. You know, 3M settled for between $10.5 and $12.5 billion on this PFAS issue in litigation with Stuart, Florida, and 300 other municipalities. DuPont reached a $1.8 billion settlement for another 300 municipalities. I'm not sure if they're the same plaintiffs. But what it means is that the municipalities and operators of these water systems are going to have to then go after the polluters in a very direct way. And that is going to be costly and time consuming to get done, to protect.
Yeah, and so, the polluters, good points, and the polluters don't cooperate. Saint-Gobain has still not settled with Hoosick Falls. They're just dragging this out for years. I mean, there have been some private litigation, some toxic tort cases. But I think also the bigger issue here is companies are still using a lot of PFAS. It's legal for them to use it. Beyond Plastics is working on an important bill in the New York State Legislature to reduce packaging. That will provide some taxpayer relief, March, and also good for the environment. Part of that bill is to prohibit the most toxic chemicals used in packaging, including PFAS. PFAS is still currently used in packaging. There was just a report that came out a few days ago that PFAS has been found in Band-Aids that we use because it's still widely used.
Is it adhesive, nonstick pans, water repellents, shampoos, cosmetics? I mean, it's really everywhere. And it's not just manufacturing operations that are discharging it to the environment. I mean, we have contamination of Washington Lake, which is a water source for Newburgh, and that's from the National Guard site there. So, you know, it's used also, I think, by in some of the chemicals that fire departments use. So it is everywhere. And water is the way that it's being delivered to 300 or 200 million Americans is what they're saying. But how are we going to get rid of it from these other places? That's my question.
Jim.
So, Judith, I'd like to follow up on that point you made about the polluters suing. I mean, in Michigan, Michigan passed a PFAS regulation of its own. It went through the state court. I believe the last ruling on it was in 23, where the appeals court in Michigan ruled that the state's drinking water regulations were invalid as the regulators did not properly, you know, determine the cost. And so we know this Supreme Court has been waiting for a case to really stifle the agency's powers to do a lot of regulation. I mean, they've signaled that in a couple of smaller cases. Do you think this might be that case?
Yes, but there's also a case coming up much quicker having to do with deference to regulatory agencies. It's referred to as the Chevron deference.
Yes.
Yeah. And this will involve not only EPA, but FDA and USDA. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court now that basically may strip federal regulatory agencies of their ability to do strong regulations, basically agency deference. We'll see how that goes. That is very, very worrisome. But I could also see, Jim, this federal regulation being challenged and going all the way up to the Supreme Court. You know, the thing about EPA, and I was very proud to work there during the Obama administration, but it is fair to say that EPA is very slow. But one of the benefits of it being slow is it is really thorough, has excellent scientists, and I believe this regulation that they announced this week is solid. It will stand up to scientific scrutiny. And I think it'll stand up to legal scrutiny, but it's always quite harrowing when you think of, you know, Brett Kavanaugh and yep. Clarence Thomas making a judgment of, is it okay to have cancer-causing chemicals in our drinking water?
I also want to mention that, Judith, you have an event. You will be speaking with Dr. David Carpenter at an environmental justice event, a memorial lecture on environmental justice for the Justice Center of Rensselaer County. Tell us more, please.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I'm really looking forward to speaking at this event organized by the Justice Center of Rensselaer County. It's on environmental justice. I'm going to do a lecture on plastic pollution, which, by the way, PFAS is in plastic. We're going to hear from the amazing Dr. David Carpenter, who's a public health physician at the Albany School of Public Health. And then after that, there's going to be a wonderful panel of Capital District environmental advocates talking about local issues. So Bob Wilton will talk about the Dunn landfill. Joe Ritchie with Lights Out Norlite will talk about the horrible pollution from the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes. Barbara Heinzen with Clean Air Coalition of Greater Ravenna Clemens will talk about the pollution from the Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna Clemens. And then Gray Campbell Cohen will talk about lead pipe replacement in Troy. So it is a packed afternoon. It's this Sunday from 1 to 3. It's free and open to the public. And, you know, after the talking and discussions, there'll be refreshments and time to network. And I'm really excited that the Justice Center has pulled this together. So it is at Albany School of Public Health, but it's in the city of Rensselaer. It's One University Place in Rensselaer. And come at 1 o'clock and stop by the Beyond Plastics table to say hi.
All right. Let's go to the letters on this subject. St. Cobain bought a Honeywell plant that had polluted for years. This is a small addition to Judith's good narrative. They were the new owner and found out about the PFAS contamination after they bought it, and to their enormous credit, they stepped up and spent zillions of dollars rectifying a problem that wasn't officially on their watch. They were good citizens. Do you agree with that letter?
No.
somehow,
not at all.
Somehow I thought you would not.
The way the law works is there's something called strict joint and several liability. So the companies like Honeywell that created the problem is responsible, and the current owners are responsible. But St. Cobain dragged their feet and did not cooperate with getting a full cleanup here or getting justice for the people whose health was damaged by this contamination. And, you know, parts of Hoosick Falls are, you know, people should know that the drinking water is safe now because of the installation of carbon filters. But many parts of Hoosick Falls are designated for Superfund site cleanup. You know, this story is far from over. And I would not describe St. Cobain as a good neighbor or a good partner in this at all.
Joe, can I comment on that?
Sure.
I had a time in my life where I worked in a corporate law firm and represented very large PRPs. Those are, you know, responsible parties under Superfund. And the mantra was money later is better than money now. And it didn't matter. Mm. We knew we were going to help our clients were going to be held liable, but the longer we could delay, that was the goal. And I think that echoes here as well.
Marge Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Friday, April 12th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org via podcast or in the WAMC app. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.